This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. This weekend, for the third time in 17 years, a pope visits Cuba. Pope Francis will pray, hold mass, and meetings with Cubans and a Castro during his 2.5-day tour of the island, which was once declared atheist. That was back in the early 1960s. It wasn't until the 1990s that Cubans were allowed to join religious groups again. Carlos Hernandez lives in South Florida now, but he remembers how religious faith was treated in Cuba when he was growing up.
In the school, they describe the church like an enemy of the human race.
Archbishop Thomas Winski in Miami is in Cuba for the Pope's visit, as he was in 1998 when Pope John Paul II became the first Pope to visit the island.
The church had to explain to a lot of the Cubans just exactly what a Pope was.
The church and Pope Francis specifically played a role in thawing the icy relations between the U.S. and Cuba recently, so his visit to Cuba this weekend and his travels next week to the United States also have a geopolitical dimension, as U.S.-Cuba relations are changing, and changing quickly. Just this week, Cuba's new ambassador to America met President Obama in the Oval Office. And today, this morning, the U.S. Treasury and Commerce Departments confirmed the further easing of trade restrictions with Cuba. So how is the Catholic Church poised to impact relations between our two countries? How about its influence on the island? Are you a Catholic Cuban? Where did you gain your faith? On the island or here in South Florida? Join the conversation here as we begin with Catholicism, Cuba, and the ever-changing relations between U.S. and Cuba here on the Florida Roundup. 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, on Twitter at WLRN, and our new Facebook group at facebook.com/group/ The Florida Roundup. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Nora Gámez-Torres with El Nuevo Herald, and David Adams is the Miami Bureau Chief with Reuters. All three, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Tim, let's talk about this papal trip. It's the third in 17 years. What's different this time?
Well, Pope Francis is, I would say, walking sort of a tightrope, because on the one hand, precisely because he's the first Latin American pope and because his agenda is so much in favor of aiding the poor, there are a lot of people who say, well, we finally have a pope who understands the nature of the Cuban Revolution and therefore will perhaps not pressure the Castro regime so hard as many, for example, here would be expecting. However, it works both ways, precisely because he is the first Latin American pope, because he does speak Spanish and knows this island. I think there is an expectation that he should be then in a position to leverage the Cuban government more strongly on issues like human rights and democratization. So there's a real juggling act he has to do in that sense.
Nora Gámez-Torres with El Nuevo Herald. Pope Francis was a soon-to-be archbishop when he first traveled with Pope John Paul II in 1998. He wrote a book about those conversations that Pope John had in Cuba. What are the expectations of Cubans, Catholic or otherwise, here in South Florida with this trip? There doesn't seem to be a significant engagement with the South Florida Catholic community like there was in 2012, for instance, during the Benedict trip.
Well, yeah, Wensky, it's taking like around 2,000 Cuban-Americans, Catholics, to the island. I think the center of the expectations are inside Cuba. Mm. I mean, Cuban people and Cuban exiles here in Miami really expect the Pope to say something about human rights and support freedoms in Cuba. I think that's critical because there's a lot of tension between the church and dissidents and Cuban exiles here, mainly around Cardinal Ortega.
Mm-hmm. The Cardinal in
very,
Cuba.
Yes, yeah. Yes. He's becoming a very controversial figure also.
And in part, David Adams with Reuters, because of some of the comments that he's made about the civil society supporters in Cuba and some of the criticism that he's had, that he's received for not supporting additional human rights on the island.
Yes, he's considered to be perhaps a little bit too polite sometimes when he talks about the Cuban government and its actions towards the Cuban people, and particularly when it comes to issues of human rights. Like Tim said, the cardinal is between a rock and a hard place. I mean, he's not in the Vatican. He's, you know, in Havana.
Yeah.
He has to daily deal with the government there. And at the same time, obviously, he's feeling pressure from exiles. here in Miami. So he is in a very difficult position. Some people feel he sometimes his statements are too cautious. But I think if you look at it really hard, and if you get a good insight into what's going on in Cuba, you'll probably find that he's actually doing a lot more behind the scenes than people realize.
Fair to say he's the second most important Catholic on the island this weekend?
Yeah, that's a fair bet. I mean, I'll give you one example. It was CNN had a story this morning that revealed one more little piece of about the secret conversations that went on between the White House and the Cuban mm-hmm. government, and revealed that one of the spies or the agents who was released by Cuba mm-hmm. and brought back to the United States, a chap called Seraf, he actually apparently wrote a letter to Cardinal Ortega offering himself as part of the deal, and Ortega passed that on to the Cuban authorities. So that's, you know, he plays that conduit role.
Let's go to Havana. Dan Trotta covers the island for Reuters. He is joining us now from Havana. Dan, give us a scene in anticipation of the Pope's arrival tomorrow afternoon.
Cubans are very happy about this trip. They like the attention. They like the fact that this Pope seems to identify with the common man. They're also hopeful that perhaps it will affect their daily lives in a positive way. But in reality, I think people are skeptical that it will. They think it's all very nice to have the Pope come to Cuba, but they don't really see that it's going to generate jobs or better income for them or their family.
Yeah, Dan Trotta with Reuters. It's tough communication with Havana, but let's continue on here and take as much as we can. Dan, give us an idea of the preparations that have been underway. We know the infrastructure in Havana and throughout Cuba is old, it is worn, it is tired. It's been able to withstand a Pope's visit in 1998 and a Pope's visit in 2012. Tell us about the preparations this time around.
Well, anyway, the Pope's going. Havana has gotten a little bit of a makeover. Streets have been paved. The Plaza of the Revolution, where the Mass will take place on Sunday, is being prettied up. Hung an enormous poster of Christ from the National Library, which is a bit jarring for those who grew up in an atheist country. And the altar has been built right there in the Plaza of the Revolution, in between other similarly large images of Che Guevara and Camilo Cienfuegos, two revolutionary heroes. So yes, the Pope's visit is always a lot of theater, a lot of pageantry, and the Cubans are playing along with that quite well. It's good publicity for them, particularly on the issue of the U.S. economic embargo, because previous popes as well have always urged the United States to lift the embargo, and Cuba's hoping to hear that message again from this pope.
Yeah, Dan Trotta joining us from Havana with Reuters with a bit of a scratchy communication line, talking about some of the paving and painting of streets and buildings and hanging of posters in the plazas awaiting Pope Francis's visit on the ground tomorrow afternoon, with Mass Sunday morning and a meeting Sunday afternoon with Raul Castro. Dan Trotta with Reuters, thank you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Now, Dan mentioned, of course, the trade embargo. That is of a political football here in the United States as well. Nora Gámez-Torres from El Nuevo Herald, I want to ask you, though, how important is that issue in relation to the papal comments that will be made on the island compared to human rights and pushing the Cuban government for human rights? On one hand, right, one part of the teeter-totter pushing the Cuban government for more personal liberties and talking about the impact of the now half-century-old plus U.S. trade embargo.
That's actually, I think, what the Pope probably would do, like try to comment something about the embargo. There's have been some comments coming from the Vatican saying that the Vatican is against the embargo against Cuba. And it's probably what the Pope would choose to do in his homilies, like criticizing, of course, embargo. But I think there's a lot of pressure also for the Pope to comment something on freedom and human rights. And also because there's, you know, we have here in Miami an activist on a hunger strike. There's another activist in Cuba on a hunger strike, too. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, pressure coming from every
In the meantime, the economic pressure to some degree is easing. Even today, David Adams with Reuters, the Treasury Department and the Commerce Department announcing an easing of further restrictions, an easing of restrictions when it comes to the U.S. engagement with Cuba, not impacting the trade embargo. That would take an act of Congress. But tell us about some of these fewer restrictions now between the two countries.
Well, what they announced today was really more a clarification of measures that have already been taken. Because the embargo legislation has been in place for so long, when they started rewriting the regulations earlier this year in January, they didn't quite get the first draft right. And they've had some pushback from the business community saying, look, you know, you say we can do this, but actually the regulations say we can't. Mm. And so what they've done is they've revised the regulations, they've made them clear, they've made them more specific. And the main areas that they're touching upon are aviation. Airlines now will not have to request a license for every time they go to Cuba. There'll be a general license.
That could move the transportation away from solely charter planes
right,
from the United States to commercial flights.
That kind of opens the door to regularly scheduled flights for companies like American.
Yeah.
Similarly, for cruise ships, a general license for cruise ships, so individual cruise lines don't need to go through all of that palaver. The Americans will be allowed to open bank accounts in Cuba.
I want to talk about that, Tim Padgett. This allows the previous restrictions allowed Americans to use credit cards while traveling in Cuba with the 12 travel designations that you could go over for humanitarian reasons, cultural exchanges, those kinds of things. But now the new regulations announced here Friday morning would allow one to open a bank account in Cuba.
You've got to look at this from the standpoint of the larger agenda here for the Obama administration, which is using these new regs to jumpstart small entrepreneurs in Cuba. You can't really do that unless you get a better back and forth flow of assets and opening these kinds of opening authorization for people to have these kinds of bank accounts there is really a necessary in that regard.
And on top of that, these regulations would allow American companies to open offices in Cuba for the first time.
Have a physical presence there.
Right. And and as some of the companies, some of the lawyers here in Miami who are expert on this were telling me this morning that, you know, what we had before now was kind of a virtual trade. You really need to have, you know, a presence in that space. And the example they gave is, you know, you could have a mini Home Depot opening a warehouse in Havana.
Nora, how likely is that?
Well, that's the big question. Like, you know, the officials have said that these steps are significant, but we have to wait to see, like, the reaction of the government. Actually, now, like, telecommunication companies are allowed to enter in joint ventures with Cuban state companies, like Etexa. I think that's major.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's a lot of other measures that, for example, hiring Cuban nationals, in which we don't know if the Cuban government is going to allow to U.S. companies to hire freely the Cubans in the island, which is not allowed so far.
And be paid by an American company through an American bank account that's being held at a Cuban bank.
Exactly. And the Cuban officials, for instance, they also don't know in which currency these bank accounts are going to be offered to Americans. They don't know if they're going to be in dollars or CUC, which is the Cuban convertible pesos.
Tim, I want to ask you, David described these as a bit of a clarification, but the timing cannot be mistaken here. It happens, of course, you know, within 24 hours of the Pope landing, within about 96 hours of the Pope addressing a joint session of Congress.
The timing, in fact, is the most important aspect of what Treasury announced today, much more than the content and the clarifications that David's talking about. The fact that they're announcing it right now, I think, you know, gives this movement of the Obama administration to get rid of the embargo more momentum. And I think that's really what the aim was.
And, of course, the Vatican has positioned this papal trip as another bridge-building effort between Cuba and, of course, the Catholic Church, between Cuba and the United States, and really between Cuba and the rest of the world. Ingrid Solano is originally from Costa Rica. She lives in Key West now. We spoke with her as she boarded a charter flight early this morning from Key West to Cuba, hoping to see the Pope.
I love this Pope because he's trying to help the relationship between United States and Cuba through the Catholic Church.
And we've heard a lot about this bridge building effort, this effort that began with the first papal trip 17 years ago. The bridge existing today, Tim, between Cuba and the Catholic Church can be described as what? Solid?
Oh,
precarious?
Solid and almost quasi-symbiotic, to tell you the truth. I mean, I think what you're seeing, what you'll be seeing showcased this weekend more than anything else, is the Catholic Church and the Cuban government helping each other promote mutual interests. The church,
and those interests are?
The church needs to rebuild its corporate presence in Cuba, which the Castros decimated back in the early 1960s when they declared Cuba an atheist state and all but shut down the entire Catholic Church institution there. That was the church was given a chance to rebuild itself in the late 1990s when Pope John Paul II visited, and the Cuban government, it's a good PR coup for them because it makes it makes the regime look more tolerant,
more open, more tolerant,
more open. And I think it's just, it helps both of them in that sense, because Raul Castro, really, the Catholic Church has become the only non-communist institution he trusts. The Catholic Church isn't just a spiritual presence in Cuba. It is really an institution that Raul is using to help push his economic reform agenda
Talking about the Pope and politics, Cuba and Catholicism on the eve of the papal trip. Pope Francis is due to land in Havana at 4 o'clock Saturday afternoon here on the Florida Roundup. Jose joins the conversation from Miami Lakes. Jose, welcome to the program. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you so much. It's really, really, really great to be here. I got to tell you, first-time caller, long-time listener, also long-time Cuban, second-time Catholic, and I'll tell you what I mean.
Second-time Catholic.
You see, I'm young. I'm only 23 years old, and I still try to keep touch with my family that's still on the island. So this time when I call my grandma, she reminds me for the second time. First time was 2012. She reminds me to be a good Catholic boy, and am I doing my good Catholic civic duty? And that is indicative, if you'll allow, that's indicative of what it has been like being a young Cuban living in the States with a Catholic background. Here in the States, I vote Democrat. I don't. I consider myself mostly agnostic. I don't know what's out there, but I hope it's something good. But if I were to step foot on a plane or step foot on Cuban soil, you bet my grandmother would wring my ear off if she heard me say anything like that. I am a diehard Catholic as far as she's concerned, and that's the same experience that a lot of my peers have. Is it's more like a trend thing for her. Now she's a Catholic again because the Pope is coming back to town. But afterwards, I live my life the way that she raised me to live my life. It's just kind of do the Hippocratic oath that grandmothers teach their children sometimes, and that's first do no harm. And just kind of continue to do no harm. And when
Jose, we can hear you wrestling with your faith even on this phone call here at this point. But we appreciate your sharing of the stories here. As you described yourself, a Cuban, a come again Catholic. What would you like to hear from Pope Francis in Cuba?
Sometimes I feel like politics tend to look at the big picture a lot, and you sometimes forget the people that are going to be affected by the effects of those politics, by the legislation. I have my grandparents and my aunts and my cousins, some of whom are my age and who have none of the opportunities that I do in Cuba. I would absolutely love if this newfound, hopefully this newfound relationship between the Cuban government and the Catholic Church benefits them, benefits the little guy, benefits my cousin driving a taxi around Havana. That's what I want. I would love if the Pope were to cement that relationship and were to help Cuba keep making these changes that I view as definitely positive for the people, which is I think what matters, the people of Cuba. more than anything.
Jose, we get it. We appreciate you sharing your faith and your input there from Miami Lakes, and it's shared by a lot of young Catholics here in South Florida. Pedro Garcia is an 11th grader at Belen Jesuit Prep School in Miami. This morning, he offered this prayer for more freedoms for Cubans.
Cuba, the birthplace of a lot of families here and the birthplace of our school, has been under the control of a totalitarian regime for 56 years. Basic human rights that we take for granted, such as the right of freedom of speech, freedom of press, and peacefully assembly, are suppressed. Let us pray that the Holy Father's visit to the island nation become a source of hope for people that have been suffering for way too long.
But that hope extends clearly beyond the faithful, beyond the Catholic Church. Esperanza, who describes herself as a devout Cuban Catholic in Miami Lakes, wrote our Public Insight Network saying, "For the non-practicing Cuban Catholic, the visit of our Holy Father brings hope to a people that are now numb by abandonment, betrayal that has lasted a half century." There, a non-practicing Cuban Catholic added, "For the average Cuban, this is another orchestrated charade. The Pope's expected message of hope will fall on the ears of a country waiting for divine intervention." We're talking about Catholics and Cuba, the Pope and politics here on the Florida Roundup. Nora Gámez-Torres with El Nuevo Herald with it, Davis Adams with the Reuters, the Miami bureau chief at Reuters, and Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here on WLRN. 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Nora, you hear these sentiments of the faithful about not only what they would like to hear, but also the hope of other Catholics and how they interpret the Pope's message, but also other faiths and what this means for somebody with the symbolism of the Pope coming. What had changed after Pope John Paul's visit in 1998? What had changed on the island after Pope Benedict's visit in 2012? And what are the expectations for 6 months from now, a year from now, after Pope Francis has gone and left?
Well, the thing is, all these trips, papal trips, are very symbolic. And also, I think it's nice for Cubans in the island just listen to someone that's not, you know, a member of the government, which are the ones that give speeches on the TV and the official media. In some other practical terms, for instance, like after Jean Paul's the second trip to Cuba, like the churches in Miami and Cuba were able to arrange kind of annual meetings, mm-hmm. and they all say that these have had a very good impact on the relationship between the Catholic communities in Miami and Cuba. But if I want to add something that Tim was talking about, and the thing is, the church here is playing a long-term goal, a long-term play. For instance, Archbishop Wensky just said to me that the Catholic Church wants a peaceful transition in Cuba, and that's where they're working for. So they haven't abandoned, some sort of social kind of goals in the island. They just don't want to play out hard.
A peaceful transition, yes. Post
a peaceful
Raul
landing,
Castro.
He told me. Yes,
a transition in terms of the leadership, yeah. Not the economic.
Yeah,
and
he
social
told me
systems.
We need to change the culture, not the government.
The comment that you read from one of the listeners about divine intervention.
Yes,
it's not really about divine intervention. It's about biological intervention. You know, one of these days, they're all going to be dead, fairly soon. The old leadership in Cuba, and there's a realization of that here in Miami, like young Jose was saying, mm-hmm. on the phone call. They are the new generation, and the old generation in Cuba knows its time is gradually running out. The real challenge for the church, and this is something that Archbishop Wensky has spoken a lot about, and I think we'll hear a lot about it from the Pope, whose theme is the missionary of mercy, is forgiveness and reconciliation.
Right. Right.
How
right.
do you bury 54 years of hatred and discord and what the Archbishop referred to as a sea of resentments? You can't build a future on a sea of resentments, which is his phrase. And the church is obviously very well suited to helping to play that role of bridge building and healing the past.
And it goes both ways, Tim. We've heard this from the Archbishop here in Miami. This forgiveness is for South Floridians of Cuban descent to give and forgive their brothers and sisters who remain on the island and reconcile with what has happened over the past almost 60 years now.
Right. And I think that's why it's so significant that we received a call from a 23-year-old Cuban-American, or an ABC, as they often call themselves, American-born Cubans. It's that younger, more moderate, more forward-thinking generation of Cuban-Americans that is really, I think, responsible for this new direction we're taking. And I think they and President Obama and Pope Francis really, there's sort of a triangulation there. They all have the same, I think they're all on the same page in terms of, you know, as Norit put, you know, they're not wanting sort of a violent upheaval regime change. What they want to do is put themselves, both the United States, the church, and younger Cuban Americans here, they want to put themselves in a position to be ready to influence change in Cuba when it comes, as David pointed out, biologically.
Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. The David there is David Adams with Reuters. He's going to stick with us. We're going to talk politics next. And Nora Gámez-Torres with El Nuevo Herald, our partner. Thank you so much for joining us again, Nora. Great to see you again. Still to come on the Florida Roundup, from voting records to vaccines, we'll fact check the Republican presidential debate. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. From immigration to childhood vaccines, Iran to the potency of pot, Republicans held their second presidential debate this week. Now, because of the size of the field, it was held in two batches, with 11 of the candidates performing best in the polls meeting in a primetime setting. Plenty of accusations, plenty of personal assertions, and a little bit of public policy debate during the almost three-hour event. So did you sit through all of it? Did you sway your opinion during the broadcast, or did it solidify your support? Are presidential politics even on your mind now, more than 6 months from the Florida primary and more than a year from Election Day? It's politics, presidential style, here on the Florida Roundup now. 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, on social media at WLRN on Twitter and Facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Our guests include Amy Sherman, Miami Herald's PolitiFact Florida reporter, and David Adams, the Miami bureau chief for Reuters, continues with us. So as presidential debates go, Amy, what'd you think overall?
It was long. 3 hours.
Yes, it was.
You know, they all tried to knock Trump out, and he fought back, and there wasn't really one overall key moment here that stuck out for me.
David, how about you? Style versus substance in this second debate.
You know, I loved it. And I didn't think I would. I didn't actually realize when I started watching it, it was going to last 3 hours. I hadn't looked at the TV schedule. But I did actually sit through the whole thing. I found it vastly entertaining. And actually a lot more interesting and substantive than I had imagined, because the format was so good. Mm. Normally the debates are so stiff. Mm-hmm. Everyone, you know, has their memorized talking points, and they get the opportunity basically to recite those rehearsed lines. This was so much, you know, people intervene, jumping in.
It was less formal.
I want to speak.
90
you know,
seconds.
Their arms.
You, Senator, have 90 seconds, and Governor, yeah, you got 30 seconds to respond. We didn't have any of those formal rules.
And I love this idea that if someone mentions your name, you get to, you know, hit them back. And I thought, you know, I thought CNN did a great job with the questions. I thought the questions were, they weren't necessarily the best questions, but they were questions that were quite cleverly designed to get people talking and perhaps attacking each other.
Well, we certainly had plenty of that. We had plenty of accusations. So, Amy, let's put it up on the PolitiFact gauge here and begin with our first fact check here. The accusation, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush was asked a question about whether he is beholden to his political donors, which led to this exchange with Donald Trump.
The one guy that had some special interest that I know of that tried to get me to change my views on something that was generous and gave me money was Donald Trump. He wanted casino gambling in Florida.
I didn't want it.
Yes, you did.
Totally false.
You wanted it and you didn't get it because I was opposed to casino gambling before, during, and after. And that's not, I'm not going to be bought by anybody.
I promise if I wanted it, I would have gotten it.
No way, Ben.
Believe me.
Nope.
I know my people.
Not even possible.
I know my people.
All right. Trump says he knows his people, Amy, but does he know his own history? Did Trump work for a casino here?
Well, we rated Jeb Bush's claim mostly true. Now, this pertains to when Jeb was running for governor in the 98 race, and Trump gave to Bush's campaign. He held a fundraiser for him. Trump Hotel and Casino Resorts gave generously to the Republican Party of Florida. And several news articles at the time said that Trump was trying to open casinos on Seminole tribal land. Even though Bush was known for being an opponent of gambling for years, he'd once served on the board of No Casinos, which opposed casino development in Florida.
So mostly true accusation on the part of Governor Bush that he was an opponent to casinos. The exchange, though, between the former governor and Donald Trump continued. And remember, Bush was actually asked this question. This was a question related to Governor Bush. Trump interrupted, and then this ensued.
You got, according to your to what you said on one of the talk shows, you got Hillary Clinton to go to your wedding.
That's
because
true.
You gave her
That's
money.
True.
Maybe it works for Hillary Clinton.
I was, excuse
it doesn't
me,
work
Jeff,
for anybody on Jeff, this on this stage.
I was a
this,
businessman. I got along with Clinton. I got along with everybody. Yeah. That was my job, to get along with people.
But the simple
I didn't wanna,
fact
excuse
is...
Excuse me. One second.
No.
I
the
didn't
simple
wanna,
fact is,
Jeff,
Donald, you cannot take...
More energy tonight. I like
no.
that.
Look. I was asked the question.
I didn't want... It was my obligation as a businessman to my family, to my company.
You can kind of continues on from there. David Adams with Reuters. I found the staging of this to be very interesting. Governor Bush had the stage. It was his question. And for at least that moment, he ceded it to Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, I saw CNN had a very good body language person on yesterday. I hadn't realized quite at the time, but you kind of sensed it that there was that Jeb was trying to be strong, but his body language wasn't coming, was saying the opposite. And in fact, when the expert was explaining it, you know, when Jeb was saying, you know, no, Donald, he was nodding his head in agreement. And when he said, I'm going to be my own man, not like my father or my brother, he was shrugging his shoulders. While I think, you know, verbally, Jeb got some of his points across, his body is still giving him trouble.
The substance was there, but perhaps the style wasn't there. Senator Rubio, Marco Rubio, of course, was on stage. He was one of the 11 GOP presidential candidates for the main presidential event, the main debate here that happened this week. And he had his foreign policy chops on display, talking about national security and the need for the next president to be someone who, quote, understands these issues and has good judgment, end quote. And this kind of a veiled reference, Amy, to what most people probably guessed was Donald Trump. And Trump responded in kind.
Well, you have to understand, I am not sitting in the United States Senate with, by the way, the worst voting record there is today.
There's that accusation, the worst voting record there is today. Amy Sherman with PolitiFact, our partner at Miami Herald. Does Senator Rubio have the worst voting record in the United States Senate?
We rated Trump's claim mostly true. It is true if you look at missed votes out of the current senators who are running for president. This year, Rubio missed nearly a third of his votes. If we look at career tenure, however, still among that presidential candidate group, he is a close second to Ted Cruz of Texas.
This David Adams accusation, mostly true accusation by Donald Trump, hits right at the heart of engagement, right at the heart of are you doing your job, something that the founder of The Apprentice certainly knows a thing or two about.
Yes, but Rubio, of course, had a very good comeback on that.
Let's listen to the comeback here. Here's what Senator Rubio said to explain his voting record.
And you're right, I have missed some votes, and I'll tell you why, Mr. Trump. Because in my years in the Senate, I figured out very quickly that the political establishment in Washington, D.C., in both political parties, is completely out of touch with the lives of our people. You have millions of people in this country living paycheck to paycheck, and nothing's being done about it. We are about to leave our children with $18 trillion in debt, and they're about to raise the debt limit again. We have a world that grows increasingly dangerous, and we are eviscerating our military spending and signing deals with Iran.
So did Senator Rubio explain his absence from Capitol Hill? He talked about all these problems, but as a way of explaining why he's not present?
Well, yeah, his answer was kind of, well, why bother? You know, Washington's dysfunctional. I may be a senator for an important state like Florida, but I don't believe in any of this stuff. And in fact, he said, you know, I'm leaving the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of made
he's
it
not running
sound
for Senate,
like he's
running
leaving
for president.
I hadn't heard him ever say it quite like that, that I'm leaving the Senate because the Senate sucks. Basically.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that argument maybe wouldn't work in a presidential campaign, but I think in a primary, it could be quite effective and sort of eat into Trump land.
Perhaps certainly in a Republican primary where you are, you know, one of 11 candidates on the stage, on the main stage, looking for the party faithful to come over and support your candidate, not only by voice, but also by vote and by dollars.
Well, and especially this sort of this new category of Republican voter, which doesn't want a politician, even a Republican, as a candidate. They want a non-politician. And so, you know, if you're Marco Rubio or Governor Christie, you know, you've got to suddenly, you know, disassociate yourself from your entire political career and be someone you haven't been, and be a Carly Fiorina, be a Donald Trump, or be a Ben Carson.
Senator Rubio was not the only politician making a simple declaration of what he is doing or has done in the case of Governor Bush. He acknowledged smoking pot. He admitted to using marijuana 40 years ago. Amy Sherman, this is not an automatic disqualification, even in the Republican race, like it may have been just 20 years ago, 30 years ago, certainly. But then during this conversation, during the Republican debate regarding marijuana, we heard this from former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina after she mentioned that she lost a daughter to drug addiction.
We are misleading young people when we tell them that marijuana is just like having a beer. It's not. And the marijuana that kids are smoking today is not the same as the marijuana that Jeb Bush smoked 40 years ago. We do.
Making that comparison that the marijuana today, the pot today, is more potent than it was four decades ago. The rating in PolitiFact is?
True. The main psychoactive ingredient is THC, and researchers at the University of Mississippi have looked at samples of pot dating back to the 70s, and they found that the potency was in the neighborhood of 3% in the early 90s, and then it rose to nearly 9% by 2008. Also, samples with a potency of 9% or higher have also risen.
So more potent pot today than there was 40 years ago for Governor Bush.
Yeah, you know, I thought that the marijuana discussion resulted in one of the most interesting exchanges between Rand Paul and Governor Christie. Governor Christie had stated that if he became president, he would outlaw marijuana nationwide. And Rand Paul said, you know, hang on a second, I thought you were for the 10th Amendment, mm-hmm. you know, states' rights.
Right.
What happened there? And I thought it was, you know, a rare, strong moment for Rand Paul in a debate where he was kind of otherwise rather left out and maybe one of those ones who's, you know, who's soon going to drop out. He made a very good point. You know, there are Republicans who are very, very strong on the issue of states' rights, but then they come back with odd statements like that on marijuana.
Now, just as a point of clarification, Carly Fiorina spoke about her daughter. It was her stepdaughter who passed away from drug addiction in 2009. After Governor Bush's admission of smoking pot, Bush's staff sent out a tweet saying, "Sorry, Mom." And it was the most retweeted post by a candidate during the debate. I believe about 20,000 retweets and counting here as we're speaking Friday afternoon. Now, a couple of doctors on stage. You mentioned one, of course, Dr. Rand Paul, an ophthalmologist, Dr. Ben Carson, a pediatric neurosurgeon. The talk turned to vaccines during this debate. Donald Trump has repeated now discredited claims that have linked childhood vaccines to autism. Those studies have been discredited. Dr. Carson was asked if Trump should stop making that claim.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is we have extremely well-documented proof that there's no autism associated with vaccinations. But it is true that we are probably giving way too many in too short a period of time. And a lot of pediatricians now recognize that and I think are cutting down on the number and the proximity in which those are done.
And that's,
I think
that's all I'm saying, Jake.
You can hear Donald Trump there agreeing with Dr. Carson. Amy Sherman, PolitiFact, Miami Herald. Are pediatricians reducing the number and frequency of childhood immunizations?
We gave Carson a pants on fire for this claim, which is our lowest rating for a claim which we find ridiculous. All the mainstream medical organizations, such as the American Academy of Pediatrics, The CDC and the Institute of Medicine all support the schedule for vaccines, which includes giving sometimes more than one vaccine in a single visit. Now, there have been a survey of doctors that showed that nearly all pediatricians face requests by parents every month to delay their child's vaccines. And the doctors do usually acquiesce to these parents' wishes. However, it's not due to any scientific reasons, but more simply because they want to keep these parents as patients. We interviewed several doctors. They all agreed that there's no evidence that the children are getting too many vaccines. There's no medical evidence that there's any issue with the proximity of the vaccines.
The number and the frequency concerns that were voiced by Dr. Carson rated as a pants on fire with PolitiFact on this one.
Right. And the interesting thing about this claim was as soon as he made it on Twitter, we instantly saw doctors challenging him and telling him he was wrong. The American Academy of Pediatrics put out a statement disputing what he said fairly quickly.
Amy Sherman heads up the PolitiFact unit for our partner, the Miami Herald. David Adams, the Miami bureau chief for Reuters. Thanks to both of you talking politics here today. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
We've got plenty more to come here on the Florida Roundup. The Broward Commission's effort to bring Uber back slows down for the time being. It's the Florida Roundup back on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Broward commissioners went long into the night on Thursday debating the effort to lure Uber and other transportation network companies back to the county. Since July 31st, recall that Uber and Lyft and others have not picked up passengers in Broward, leading to an outcry among customers and the county commission considering new, easier rules for the companies to do business. Broward Commissioner Barbara Sharif represents the 8th District in the great county of Broward. She's with us here on the Florida Roundup. Welcome to TFR, Commissioner. Nice to see you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Late night and early morning for you. Do you support the general effort to get transportation network companies operating in Broward?
Yes, and I believe that the whole commission has always supported that. The sticking points have always been public safety and the ability to know who's picking up our customers and to control that.
A number of amendments were offered last night. There were a number of individual votes on specific regulations. The whole wrap-up, kind of an omnibus ordinance, is due to be voted on in mid-October. But I want to walk through some of the ideas that you and your fellow commissioners debated and voted on last night. One was as simple as a geography test.
Correct.
Yes. Do you support the fact that to have transportation network drivers, Uber drivers, Lyft drivers, to know their way around Broward County?
They really need to, but obviously my fellow commissioners outvoted me on that one. They said that everybody uses technology. They use a smartphone, so they have Google Maps and they can get them around. My experience with Google Maps, just as it was today, sometimes it takes you the longer route.
So well, you made it here on time, though.
Right. Yeah. So if you know your way around, that's a good thing.
Do more highly regulated for-hire drivers, cab drivers, limousine drivers have to take a geography test to get licensed?
They Every do. Chauffeur driver right now has to take a geography test and pass it.
And that's an interesting language difference. You call it a chauffeur driver, which is what the regulation calls a taxi driver in Broward. These would not be considered chauffeurs, they would be considered drivers.
No, they're categorized as chauffeur drivers, but the subcategory is TNC. That's the difference.
That's the difference, and that is the lower regulation TNC.
Correct.
Transportation Network Company.
Correct. And I do believe that there's a lot of misperception out there in regards to what we've done to keep them here. We've literally bent over backwards. In terms of the taxi cab industry, they've been allowed only one car per 2,500 people in the county. So they're regulated by census and population, whereas Uber is unlimited vehicles, and we've given them that.
And are you satisfied with that?
I was satisfied with that from October of last year. Where our sticking points came down was the level two background screening.
Yep.
And the vehicle inspection.
Let's talk about those. Level two is fingerprinting background screening. There had been conversations about having a third party handle that, not the county handle that. Where do you stand on this issue?
So basically, typically in all the cases, a third party handles it through the FDLE.
And the Florida Department of Law Enforcement.
Right, Florida Department of Law Enforcement. So you would go in to a department where you get your fingerprints scanned in. It goes into a central database, and then the Florida Department of Law Enforcement would kick back all of your records from the entire United States.
Right.
And it's kind of a one-stop shopping type of deal where you get everything with Uber.
Are you insistent on that? Level of background check?
Listen, after last night, yes, because I had acquiesced and said to Uber, fine, go ahead and do your background checks the way you want to do it. But last night, they submitted an addendum stating that they had no way of knowing through their particular system when a felon was released from jail.
And there was also an amendment offered that would allow felons, except for those convicted of sexual crimes, crimes involving a deadly weapon, or crimes against police officers, to be able to legally drive with a TNC, a transportation network company. Do you support that effort?
No.
No, you're against
that. And the reason
why
I do not is because two people testified on different occasions that they pick up unaccompanied minors in Uber cars. And if you're going to be transporting children, you need to be on the up and up.
Is that allowing felons to be Uber and Lyft drivers a poison pill for you? In other words, you will vote against any ordinance that allows those companies to operate in that fashion.
I did.
Regardless of the other support that you may have.
Correct. I supported other portions of the ordinance, but that I just don't. I think public safety, you cannot compromise for public opinion.
1-800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Get those calls in quickly. We're speaking with Barbara Sharif, Broward County Commissioner, on the effort to bring Uber back. Now let's talk about the vehicle inspection. County mechanics to inspect vehicles that had been on the table. Is that something you're going to be insistent on, that county mechanics look at folks' cars?
I voted on last night to go ahead and allow them to go to whatever ASC certified mechanic that they would choose.
And allowing an annual inspection or a biannual inspection for older vehicles.
So a annual inspection for vehicles 6 years or less, biannual for vehicles above 6 years.
I also want to ask you about a 24-hour customer service line and a physical office in Broward County. These were regulations that the county originally were desirous of, but apparently have given up. You're shaking your head. No need for a 24-hour customer service line?
Well, in my personal experience, a 24-hour service line didn't help me when I rode an Uber. I had a bad experience, and I still to this day have not gotten an answer back. And I use my app and responded through the technology that I was given. So I don't really think that makes or breaks the deal, neither here nor there. I could care less about that.
Unlimited county audits. The county wanted the ability to look through the business records and the personnel files.
Oh, part of that was because they have been driving illegally and picking up and dropping off at our airport. And as you know, there's a $3 per trip charge that they haven't been paying.
And Uber has offered to pay $4.50 for only one side of that,
correct,
not $3 on both sides, a pickup and a drop off.
Correct. So they're asking for a big discount. So if a taxi cab comes in and out, they pay $6. Uber wants to pay $4.50.
The way that the ordinance sits here today on this Friday, September 19th, does it have your support?
Yes, it does, because the background portion of it was kept as more stringent. So yes, it does at this point.
Barbara Sharif, County Commissioner for Broward County, with us here on the Florida Roundup. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Roundup this week, the Pope isn't the only global rock star with Cuba on his itinerary. According to Spanish newspaper El Mundo, the Rolling Stones are finishing negotiations for a concert in March in Havana. An official announcement is expected later this year. As a band, the Stones are 3 years younger than the Castro Revolution. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. We want you to join our new Facebook group. Let us know what you're talking about. Facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Our program is produced by Julia Duba and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Our public insight network analyst is Chibeli Herrera. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Maris. And our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. We'll talk with you Monday morning on the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.